the limelight.
The Rainforest Foundation Norway RFN analysis found human activities, including logging and land use changes, often for farming, have destroyed 34% of all growth tropical rainforests and degraded 30% worldwide. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Frightening New Data Shows Humanity Has Degraded or Destroyed Two-Thirds of World's Rainforest. Stay tuned for more. New data from a Norwegian nonprofit is generating fresh concerns about humanity's destruction of the natural world, revealing that people have ravaged about two-thirds of original tropical rainforest cover globally. The Rainforest Foundation Norway RFN analysis found that human activities, including logging and land use changes, often for farming, have destroyed 34% of old growth tropical rainforest and degraded 30% worldwide. RFN defined degraded forest as those that are partly destroyed or fully wiped out, but replaced by more percent growth. The group's definition for intact forest, considered too strict by some experts, includes only areas that are at least 500 square kilometers or 193 square miles. Trees and biodiversity are at greater risk in smaller zones. The RFN findings reported by Reuters show that over half of the destruction since 2002 has been in the Amazon and neighboring rainforests. Deforestation in South America, particularly within Brazil, home to the majority of the Amazon, has caused recent alarm given the role of rainforest in trapping carbon. Forests act as a two-lane highway in the climate system, explained Nancy Harris, Forest Program Research Director at the World Resources Institute, WRI, earlier this year. Standing forests absorb carbon, but clearing forests releases it into the atmosphere. A forest carbon flux map released in January by organizations including WRI found that between 2001 and 2019, forests emitted an average of 8.1 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide annually due to deforestation and other disturbances, but also absorbed 16 billion metric tons per year over the same period. Reuters reported recently on RFN's analysis. As more rainforest is destroyed, there is more potential for climate change, which in turn makes it more difficult for remaining forests to survive, said the report's author Andres Kroke, a tropical forest researcher. It's a terrifying cycle, Kroke said. Total loss between just 2002 and 2019 was larger than the area of France he found. Deforestation has surged in Brazil since far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, a foe of both environmental regulations and indigenous people in his country, took office in early 2019. Brazilian forest loss hit a 12-year high in 2020, according to satellite imagery from the country's space research agency. Instead of acting to prevent the increase in deforestation, the Bolsonaro government has been denying the reality of the situation, dismantling environmental agencies and attacking NGOs who work underground in the Amazon, said Greenpeace Brazilian Amazon campaigner Christine Mazzetti in response to the data. Bolsonaro enjoyed a close relationship with former U.S. President Donald Trump, and both leaders faced an onslaught of global criticism for their similar response to various crises, from the raging coronavirus pandemic to the climate emergency. Comments from Brazilian Foreign Minister Ernesto Araújo recently suggest that the recent swearing-in of U.S. President Joe Biden may mean a shift. According to Reuters, Araújo, who has called human-caused climate change a Marxist conspiracy, said the administrations are now collaborating on the crisis. Something that was regarded as an impediment is totally out of the way. We are now working together as key partners toward a successful COP26 and fully implementing climate agreements, said Araújo, referring to the United Nations Climate Summit, rescheduled for November due to the pandemic. A UN report released late last month found that international community is quite far off from meeting the Paris Climate Agreement's 1.5 degrees Celsius and 2 degrees Celsius temperature target based on the greenhouse gas emissions reduction pledges that governments have proposed for the next decade. Marcio Astorini, executive secretary of the Brazilian group Observatorio do Clima, called Bolsonaro's plan a train wreck of reduced ambition that violates the Paris Agreement by giving the country a free pass to emit 200 million tons to 400 million tons of CO2 more than the 2015 pledge. It totally eliminates any mention of deforestation control, and it lacks clarity on its conditionality, added Astorini. He warned against accepting such a dangerous precedent and called for global pressure on his government to go back to the drawing board and formulate a pledge with real targets. The Amazon represents the best hope for preserving what rainforest remains, Reuters noted, adding that Kroc found the world's largest rainforest and its neighbors, including Orinoco and the Andean rainforest, account for 73.5% of tropical forests still intact. While that fact gives hope, RFN tweeted recently, the current rate of destruction is frightening. The group found that after South American rainforests, the top deforestation hot zones since 2002 have been Southeast Asian islands, where trees have been cleared for palm oil plantations, followed by Central Africa, specifically around the Congo River Basin, where forest loss results from agriculture and logging.
Aperture.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kalouts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kalouts. I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of the lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kalouts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the Kalouts, or Yardangs. Other researchers believe the Yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these Yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these Yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky, but studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's going to be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Mega Dunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Mega Dunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kalutz or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kalutz area. Not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kalutz, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kalutz are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many kanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalut formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalutz. But the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kalutz, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kalutz. The reason they have been abraded more than the other Kalutz in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different Kalutz or Yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kalutz are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kalutz of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kalutes in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kalutes in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kalutes. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kalutes for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kalutes, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm gonna have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kalutes redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeve shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeve shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent. And as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and these goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kalutz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kaluts expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kaluts themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kalut depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalut's basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kaluts with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran, and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as Kalate and Kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word Kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kaluts of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark. When on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone Kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Siyuj Mountains back there towards the Kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This Kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just a perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the Kaluts, the winds are so strong they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the Kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the Kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the Kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to, and when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear, and if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
Nowruz is the message of peace and friendship by the Iranians for the whole world. Happy New Iranian Calendar Year! Happy Nowruz! IRIB English Radio wishes you a more than ever happy Nowruz.
the limelight.
While liquid hydrogen is the fuel of choice for the space program, having it become the primary fuel for commercial aircraft has its challenges. Aircraft designers will need to ensure that its storage on board future aircraft will be as safe as existing commercial airliners, while also developing hydrogen storage facilities at airports. We now present you an article written by Dave Makichuk. The piece is titled Dream of a Hydrogen-Powered Plane at Hand. The article has been taken from the AsiaTimes.com website. Please stay with us for more of Dave Makichuk's article. A group of Dutch students have defied many skeptical mainstream aviation experts by proceeding to unveil the world's first hydrogen-powered aircraft. According to the Robb Report, in fact, the student team from Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, which call themselves the AeroDelft team, plans to fly Phoenix PT, the world's first prototype aircraft with liquid hydrogen fuel cells, in July. The students, comprising of 23 nationalities, started the hydrogen aircraft project back in September of 2018. Sam Rotten, who managed the prototype production, said, "This is really a Christmas present feeling," he added. "Now that we have an actual plane, the team's motivation is rekindled and everyone is ready for the challenges to come." The report said the AeroDelft team recently completed the ground tests for the crewless Phoenix PT, which weighs about 113 pounds. Resembling a glider and covered with sponsor logos, it will carry 2 pounds of liquid hydrogen for its maiden flight. Hydrogen is kept in a cryogenic tank at minus 253 degrees Celsius and warmed to 0 degrees Celsius using a complex tubing system. Phoenix PT is also designed to have an unusually low noise profile. It is powered by a 1,500-watt fuel cell coupled with a battery pack for takeoff power and safety. The AeroDelft team calculates that Phoenix PT will have a range of 311 miles and flight time of up to 7 hours. The report said the AeroDelft team also began building a full-scale two-passenger aircraft, Phoenix FS, last October. It is scheduled to make its maiden flight in 2022. AeroDelft team chose liquid hydrogen to fuel its Phoenix PT aircraft because hydrogen is not only the world's lightest element, but it can pack 3 times the energy of fossil fuels without emitting any greenhouse gases. It emits only water vapor. The report said it is also designed to have an unusually low nose profile with a tail-mounted electric motor. With a wingspan of 164 feet, the full-scale Phoenix FS will have a crew of 2 and hold up to 22 pounds of liquid hydrogen for an expected range of 1,243 miles and flight time of up to 10 hours. The two-passenger model's 2022 flight will be powered by gaseous hydrogen. The report said in 2024, Phoenix FS is expected to fly with liquid hydrogen. AeroDelft team's sights are now set beyond the flight of the Phoenix, with the team's projection for the first hydrogen-powered flight around the world to happen by 2025, and the first commercial hydrogen-powered aircraft, the Greenliner, to begin operating by 2035. The Greenliner will be a liquid hydrogen airliner capable of flying 19 passengers plus pilots up to 925 kilometers or 570 miles. The report said Delft University of Technology also achieved another milestone last September, successfully demonstrating a prototype of the Flying V, a blended wing design that promises to be much more fuel efficient than traditional commercial aircraft. The Flying V's unique design places the passenger cabin, the cargo hold, and the fuel tanks in the wings, and experts hope that the plane's aerodynamic shape will cut fuel consumption by up to 20% compared to modern-day aircraft. Experts tested a 22.5-kilogram, a 3-meter scale model of the futuristic airplane developed by researchers at Delft University of Technology in partnership with Dutch airliner KLM to take the highly anticipated aircraft along its next developmental steps. The French aerospace giant Airbus also plans to fly its first zero-emission commercial aircraft this year. Its Zero-E program is looking at different configurations and technologies for hydrogen-powered aircraft. While liquid hydrogen is the fuel of choice for the space program, having it become the primary fuel for commercial aircraft certainly has its challenges. Aircraft designers will need to ensure that its storage on board future aircraft will be as safe as existing commercial airliners, while also developing hydrogen storage facilities at airports. Current hydrogen extraction is highly energy intensive, so ways to harvest green hydrogen using water electrolysis are being explored. Guillaume Faury, the Airbus chief executive, told The Guardian, "The historic moment for the commercial aviation sector marks the most important transition this industry has ever seen." Guillaume Faury says, "The concept we unveil today offers the world a glimpse of our ambition to drive a bold vision for the future of zero-emission flight." Faury added, "I strongly believe that the use of hydrogen, both in synthetic fuels and as a primary power source for commercial aircraft, has the potential to significantly reduce aviation's climate impact."
Around the World with Reporters.
Belgium's largest COVID-19 vaccination centre, located in Hazel on the outskirts of Brussels City. Like hundreds of similar venues across the EU, officials here are worried about vaccine supply. 33-year-old nurse Alex Gavoni has arrived to get the jab.
"I have a vaccination center behind my house, but I could not go there because they don't have enough supplies. And this place is a bit far away from me, for the other people that have to come. And as a nurse, I'm a bit concerned that the people will not take the vaccine because of the confusion with AstraZeneca for the moment."
AstraZeneca is contracted to supply the EU with 90 million doses before the end of this month, but will only deliver 30 million. The firm is supposed to supply 180 million doses in April, May and June, but says it will only provide 70 million.
AstraZeneca has underproduced and underdelivered.
Key EU member states will start to administer AstraZeneca again after being reassured by health authorities amid safety concerns.
"This is a safe and effective vaccine."
Experts are asking, due to the EU's dismal handling of the affair, how many people will be willing to take the jab. In any case, the German government says there are not enough vaccines in the EU to prevent a third wave. For example, infection rates are again out of control in France and Italy. Health officials say the UK variant of the virus is wreaking havoc in Poland. Many hospitals are reaching breaking point.
Health experts warn that when centres are not being fully utilised, COVID-19 mutations are allowed to develop in the community. The big concern is future variants might be even more contagious and more deadly. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, is fighting for her political life. An inquiry into her handling of the sexual harassment charges brought against her predecessor, Alex Salmond, is underway. Salmond and Sturgeon have both given evidence, but a leaked draft report has revealed committee members have voted 5-4 that Sturgeon gave them an inaccurate account of what happened. However, she says she stands by every word.
I think the first thing to say is I stand by all of the evidence I gave to the committee, all 8 hours worth of evidence. I mean, what's been clear is the opposition members of this committee made their minds up about me before I uttered a single word of evidence. Their public comments have made that clear. So this leak from the committee, very partisan leak tonight, before they've actually finalised the report, is not that surprising. So let's wait and see the final report. But more importantly, the question of whether or not I breached the ministerial code is being considered independently by James Hamilton QC, and I hope and expect to receive and publish that report soon.
If that inquiry also finds against her, she is not legally compelled to resign, but she'll be under a lot of pressure to do so. A recent poll shows her party have a 22-point lead, so she may well remain First Minister after the May elections. What's certain is Sturgeon isn't going down without a fight. In the evidence she gave earlier this month, she defended her position, accused Salmond of inappropriate behaviour, and apologised directly to the two women that were let down by the government investigation.
A number of women made serious complaints about Alex Salmond's behaviour. The government, despite the mistake it undoubtedly made, tried to do the right thing. As First Minister, I refused to follow the age-old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants.
Alex Salmond was cleared of all charges and compensated for his legal fees, but now Sturgeon is on the ropes. Many are questioning why a new policy on sexual harassment, inspired by the Me Too movement, could be used to bring down the First Minister, a woman herself and one of the most successful politicians of a generation. Analysts say one reason might be that she is also the figurehead of Scotland's independence campaigners. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Representatives of the Afghan government, influential political leaders, the Taliban and some key regional and international players have decided to continue negotiations on the fate of the Afghan peace trend in Moscow. There are two main scenarios on the negotiating table at the Moscow summit in order to bring peace to war-ravaged Afghanistan. The first scenario for the transition of power from President Ashraf Ghani is to establish a transitional government. This scenario has so far been backed by some players, including Russia, the US, Pakistan, and China. However, experts here believe the second scenario, that will most probably gain support from Iran and India, follows another solution, which is holding an early election for the transition of power. This comes while war-weary Afghans say, as their country has entered a very different phase of its history, it's too important for influential political leaders to make a united front and convince all players to just put an end to war at any cost.
Our country is bleeding and it needs help from all those who are involved in the Afghanistan crisis. But we want our own leaders to set aside their differences and lead the country to lasting peace.
Locals here also call on the Taliban to respect people's demand and honestly work on a true peace plan if they are not serving foreign players.
The Taliban needs to realize that there are no military solutions to the crisis, so it should say no to foreign demands that are against Afghanistan's national interests and closely work with others to bring calm and stability to Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that the Afghan government had already rejected Russia's agenda regarding the Afghan peace process, and now another summit is slated to be held in Turkey in 2 weeks.
The Tokyo conference will also work on the Afghan peace process, but only time will tell whether those meetings can lead the country to peace and stability. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Helpless parents in this protest held in Pakistan's capital Islamabad. They have a tragic story which they say no one is willing to listen in Pakistan. Their two sons, one after the other, disappeared. One of them disappeared 7 years ago, while the another one just last week. They have no clue about the whereabouts of their sons.
If my sons are found guilty, the government must punish them. But if not, then must set them free. But no one in the government listens to us. We don't know what to do.
This is just tip of the iceberg of the tragedy of the victims of thousands of similar cases of enforced disappearances. It all started in late 2001 when the US-led NATO forces invaded neighboring Afghanistan and Islamabad joined their so-called war on terror. Pakistan's secret services have been at the heart of allegations to have illegally detained citizens under the cover of so-called war on terror. A significant number among the detained citizens were allegedly secretly handed over to the U.S. The repeated demands of the victim families to either prosecute their loved ones or set them free have gone unheard in Pakistan. Despite promises to set them free, the successive civilian governments and judiciary have done little to help the victim families. The country's military-run secret services have mostly defied the orders of Pakistan's superior courts to release the missing citizens, languishing in jail for years, some of them well over a decade without any charge sheet.
There's no power with the politicians. There's no power with the in the democracy in Pakistan. They cannot ask them. There's no accountability of the intelligence agencies for doing illegal activities. They are out of the ambit of law. They can do anything. Any army person, any uniformed person can just blame anybody and that person will be disappeared. That person will be in jail.
In a controversial move, Pakistan's parliament provided blanket immunity to the secret services in 2014 from prosecution on the charges of illegal detention, torture, and killing of citizens. Nonetheless, this did not bring any significant let-up in enforced disappearances in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
An amnesty bill for Catalonia's jailed leaders was put before Spain's Congress of Deputies on Tuesday to end the political crisis in the northeastern region. The bill was filed by lawmakers from the four Catalan pro-independence parties with the support of Òmnium Cultural, a grassroots organization whose leader was found guilty of sedition in the 2017 referendum trial and sentenced to 9 years in jail.
We brought forward the amnesty law as a starting point for a democratic solution. If the government really believes that the repression exerted in Catalonia was a mistake, it should adopt the amnesty law as a way to correct that mistake.
Spain's ruling Socialist Party had dismissed the amnesty bill even before it reached Congress.
We have always expressed opposition against amnesty. We're always willing to accept particular cases and in accordance with the legal framework. But we have never opted for such an amnesty that undoubtedly has much more political character of acquittal.
The socialists say they favor other solutions to amnesty, namely a presidential pardon or a reform of the sedition law that sentenced the jailed Catalan leaders to up to 13 years behind bars. For the separatists, neither of these proposals addresses the hundreds of independence-related legal cases they claim are pending trial in Spain's courts.
With the amnesty bill doomed to fail from the outset, the fate of jailed leaders now goes down the path of either clemency or the reform of Spain's criminal code. A slow and winding path that even the most optimistic in Catalonia say it will lead nowhere. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
The second Tehran Dialogue Forum was held virtually, but the messages were as strong as last year's. Foreign ministers of Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan discussed the latest major issues in the Middle East, from terrorism to the U.S. destabilizing presence in the region. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made the opening speech, where he touched on the U.S. intervention in the region, saying Washington has spent billions of dollars on its military sector only to perpetuate insecurity in the region.
The U.S. has exacerbated the insecurity and instability of this region more than any other region. As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
Zarif also censured the U.S. for keeping its anti-Iran sanctions amid the pandemic, calling the measures an economic war waged against the Iranian people.
U.S. coercive economic measures directed against the Iranian people, especially at a time of pandemic, are nothing less than economic warfare. And as we now witness, there has been yet no difference in following a failed policy of the so-called maximum pressure between the former and the current U.S. president.
Echoing Zarif's remarks, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu also rejected the unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran, saying Ankara supports a U.S. return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and its full implementation.
From the very beginning, we have stood alongside Iran against unilateral sanctions. And Turkey has always supported the full implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now we support the new U.S. administration's declared intention to return to the deal. And we are hopeful that a mutually acceptable formula will be found to revive the JCPOA.
Afghan Foreign Minister Hanif Atmar was another diplomat at the virtual meeting who said his country should not become a safe haven for terrorists.
It's important for the region and for the outside world to realize the fact that outside problems should not be fought over on Afghan soil.
Tehran Dialogue Forum held its first edition last year with the presence of senior officials and heads of research institutes from different countries. The aim is to discuss views on major developments in sensitive areas, including the Persian Gulf and West Asia. It seems that the trilateral meeting boils down to a single message. Three major countries in the region, Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan, believe that it's time for the U.S. to stop its problematic behavior in West Asia. They say it can start by leaving the region and its people alone. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the U.S. interventions are aimed at dominating the region. He said the region has turned into a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Addressing the Tehran Dialogue Forum, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad highlighted the U.S. occupation of his country. He said that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and threaten other regional countries.
The United States and the European Union, or the leading countries in the European Union, are using this coalition to attack Syria, to threaten other independent countries in the region, and to claim that they are fighting against Daesh. Daesh, in fact, has been encouraged and supported by the United States.
Years of devastation in Syria caused by the U.S. and its allies with their backing to terror groups are just the tip of the iceberg. U.S. interventionist agenda in other countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya all show that